today on Against the Grain. U.S. citizenship was extended to Puerto Ricans in 1917. After World War I, they began settling in New York City in large numbers. What happened to them politically? In what ways and for what reasons did they emerge as political actors and radical activists? I'm C.S. The historian Lauren Thomas sheds light on these and other matters coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Do you know or have you heard of any Puerto Ricans who hail from New York City? Me too. Large numbers of Puerto Ricans moved from the island to the Big Apple in the early 20th century, and it may not surprise you to hear that they weren't treated particularly well and had to overcome numerous obstacles despite their status as U.S. citizens. Why was that? How were Puerto Ricans perceived by politicians, the media, and the general public? When and how did Puerto Ricans gain a political voice, assert their demands for equal rights, engage in radical activism? Lauren Thomas is a Rutgers University-based historian whose books include Puerto Rican Citizen, History and Political Identity in 20th Century New York City. A chapter she wrote, a chapter about Puerto Rican youth and the forging of a U.S. identity, is part of the new edited volume, A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered, U.S. Society in an Age of Restriction, 1924 to 1965. Later this hour, you'll hear from one of the volume's editors, Madalena Marinari. We begin the program and spend the majority of the hour with Lauren Thomas. When she joined me recently via Skype, I began by noting that Puerto Rico became a U.S. possession in 1898. When, I asked, was U.S. citizenship extended to Puerto Ricans?
It was extended to Puerto Ricans as a piece of legislation called the Jones-Shaforth Act in 1917. It had been debated off and on since 1900, essentially since the U.S. had instituted a civil government on the island following its capture of the island as a prize of war after the Spanish-Cuban-American War ended in 1898.
And when did Puerto Ricans begin settling? And I actually want to focus in on New York City, which is the focus of your article in this volume, A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered. When did Puerto Ricans begin settling in New York City in large numbers?
Well, actually, there was a notable, if small, community of Puerto Rican and Cuban exiles in New York City in the 1870s, 1860s, 70s, and then throughout the rest of the 19th century. They were part of a kind of force of exiles fighting to expel Spain from their islands. Cuba and Puerto Rico were the last remaining Spanish colonies in the Americas. The rest of Spanish America had achieved independence by the 1820s. And for various reasons, Spain had hung on to these two islands in the Caribbean. So by the 1860s, independence fighters in both islands were at war with Spain, and a small cadre of exiles settled in New York City. There were also exiles in Florida, strategizing and trying to work on another campaign against Spain. There was a 10 years war from 1868 to 78 fought just between Puerto Rican and Cuban independence fighters and Spain. And then after losing that war, they regrouped and started again in 1895. The U.S. entered that round of the war with Spain in 1898, and within several months had defeated Spain and taken possession of Puerto Rico. So the larger community of Puerto Rican migrants developed in New York City after the extension of citizenship. That simply made it easier for Puerto Ricans to settle there, to find work, to find apartments. Although, as I explore at great length in my first book called Puerto Rican Citizen, the apparent benefits of citizenship for those early migrants were usually things didn't turn out as they expected. They anticipated being immigrants with an extra advantage of citizenship, and that is not generally how things went for Puerto Rican migrants either in 1917 or in the 1970s.
And why was that the case? Why didn't citizenship conferred on Puerto Ricans by law in 1917, why did it not give the Puerto Ricans kind of what they thought they would get in terms of treatment from the authorities and opportunities?
The shortest answer is racism. They were a mixed race population, brown, foreign. So the idea that they could settle into a place like New York, that was already a city of immigrants at that time, and build communities, find work, build some economic stability, those dreams turned out to be much more complicated for people who were dark-skinned, who were identified as foreign by their accents, by their language, and also, of course, some of their customs. And the other reason, besides simply racism, is that there was a certain kind of awareness among U.S. officials, that Puerto Ricans were part of what was essentially a colony of the United States. And this is a really complicated history, a complicated relationship for the U.S. because it was a country that prided itself on not having an empire. So that to welcome into its largest metropolis, New York City, the citizens of what was essentially its only true colony, was a complicated situation that turned out to create for Puerto Ricans a far less welcoming atmosphere.
Well, it's one thing for Puerto Ricans to be formally, officially, citizens in the U.S. Did everyone, like in terms of the general public of the United States and the people who were in government, whether on the local or state or federal level, was everyone aware of that?
Most certainly not. Puerto Ricans were a mysterious entity to many Americans. For most people who encountered them, many other New Yorkers just assumed they were another foreign population. So their political status was largely unknown, and in fact, in some ways, it still is. But when in the first couple of decades of the major migration, meaning numbering in the tens of thousands after 1917, even members of Congress, many of them, had no idea that they were citizens.
That's Lauren Thomas. She's Associate Professor of History at Rutgers University, Camden. And we are talking about a chapter she contributed about Puerto Rican youth and the forging of an American identity to the new volume, A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered. So I'm reading from your article here. You write that there were probably 30,000 Puerto Ricans in New York City by 1930. Where did they live, or what did they tend to live? And who did they tend to live alongside?
They tended to live first in Chelsea, in sort of lower mid-west side of Manhattan. That was actually where the oldest community of Puerto Rican exiles dating back to the 19th century had settled. The largest community of Puerto Rican migrants by 1930 was settling in East Harlem, which at the time that they began arriving in the 19-teens after World War I was both a Jewish and an Italian neighborhood. The Jewish residents of the neighborhood were on their way out by the late 1920s, and there were not many of them left by the 1930s. In the 1930s, East Harlem was still predominantly Italian American, but by the 1940s, Puerto Ricans began overtaking the Italian population, and that produced substantial conflict throughout the 1920s, 30s, and 40s.
Yeah, and if we focus on youth, as you do in this piece, what was happening in terms of conflict and tensions between and among Italian youth and young Puerto Ricans?
There was a lot of conflict in the streets, informal gangs. Some more formal gangs had formed by the late 1930s, early 1940s, but the primary conflicts were taking place in schools. In this chapter, I focus on a couple of incidents that took place at a really interesting public high school called Benjamin Franklin High School in East Harlem. It had been started in the 1920s or early 1930s, maybe, by a liberal Italian-American education reformer named Leonard Covello. And he envisioned a multiracial school that was devoted to a curriculum based on what he called intercultural democracy or cultural pluralism. The moments of violent conflict that erupted periodically between Puerto Rican and Italian American kids, they were all boys, the school was all boys, really created some difficulties for the school officials, but they tended to respond fairly sensitively. Covello himself took the perspective that Puerto Ricans were just like other immigrants. They needed to be given the time to establish themselves, establish their communities, solidify their economic status, and just adjust, basically. And that was, he was a powerful figure in defending the growing number of Puerto Rican residents in East Harlem in the 1930s. But what I find somewhat problematic with his language, with the way he defended not just the kids, but the community at large, is that it didn't take into account the fact that Puerto Ricans suffered additional prejudice. They were not just like other immigrants because, number one, they were dark-skinned, they were mixed race, they were treated as black and relegated to, certainly in the economic sector, to the lowest level jobs and presumed to be in that place permanently. And the other disadvantage they had, as we were talking about before, was that, ironically, their disadvantage was that they were citizens, and so they were perceived as a greater threat by some sectors of the democratic machine, for instance, in New York City, which was powerful and didn't want to see a large and empowered voting bloc of Puerto Ricans because they were able to vote as soon as they arrived in the U.S.
How much did juvenile delinquency, and specifically the perceived delinquency of youth of color, become a preoccupation of government officials and the wider public? And I'm thinking about after World War II specifically, so we're moving it forward a little bit.
This was a serious preoccupation of city officials, education officials, the media. In the, I would say, the long, long decade after World War II, there was a rise in various measures of juvenile delinquency after the war. Now, some of that increase in the measures of juvenile delinquency may have had to do with the increased rate of prosecuting young people for various misdemeanors and other crimes denoted as delinquency. But what wound up happening culturally that really affected Puerto Ricans in New York was that as the concerns about delinquency and concerns about gang activity, which was pretty pervasive and was an issue in working class white communities, in African American communities, and among Puerto Ricans too, the concern about delinquency and gang issues turned into an opportunity to amplify the fears of the people who seemed most different. And certainly the young Puerto Rican men who were either part of gangs or who were assumed to be part of gangs took on this increasingly sinister looking appearance. And they got the brunt, I would say, of the negative treatment by police. I mean, this has been very well documented, that they were harassed relentlessly by police, as were African American youth. And they were arrested and prosecuted at far higher rates than working class white kids who were also part of gangs or were also connected to the activities of juvenile delinquency.
Yeah, you're right that throughout the 1950s, Puerto Ricans under the age of 25 constituted New York's fastest growing demographic group. So there were certainly a lot of Puerto Rican youth to blame and the scapegoat. That's the voice of Lauren Thomas. She teaches history at Rutgers University Camden, and she has a very interesting chapter about Puerto Ricans in New York City and Puerto Rican youth and the forging of an American identity in the new volume. It's called A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered, U.S. Society in an Age of Restriction, 1924 to 1965. The volume is edited by Madalena Marinari, Madeline Chu, and Maria Cristina Garcia. And I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You spend a fair amount of time in this article, in this chapter, talking about education and educational opportunities for Puerto Ricans. What were their needs, and were they being met?
The primary need was for some kind of bilingual teaching. Many of the kids who arrived, and this was true certainly in the 1920s, it was also true when the massive migration from the island of Puerto Rico began in the late 1940s, and the majority of those people, many of them children, wound up in New York City. So no matter what decade the children of migrants arriving from the island needed to begin schooling with some bilingual teaching. Most of them did not speak English when they arrived in the U.S. So bilingual education and bicultural education, which is a different thing, but it's closely connected. It's the idea that children respond best, they learn best when their own culture, their own kind of cultural knowledge base was part of their learning in the classroom. And this was quite a struggle. The school district of New York, even though a substantial proportion of children in New York schools by the 1950s were Puerto Rican, somewhere around 20% by the 1950s, that number was 30% in the 1960s. So there was a lot of lobbying to expand bilingual education and bicultural education. The school district made some efforts in the early 1950s and at various other points in the 1950s to hire bilingual teachers, to recruit more teachers from the island of Puerto Rico to come to New York and take jobs in the school district. But the perception, not surprisingly, was consistently that there was not nearly enough support and funding and training for these programs.
And what you're beginning to talk about, and I think you like to highlight in your writing, and it deserves to be highlighted, is activism. Activism by Puerto Rican community leaders and parents and often young people to redress, to address some of the problems, the way in which discrimination operated or opportunities weren't extended in an equal way to Puerto Ricans. There was a young migrant named Antonia Pantoja. Tell us a little bit about the groups that she helped found to address the needs of Puerto Rican youth.
Antonia Pantoja was a very important leader throughout the 1950s and 1960s and thereafter. A very important leader of education-related activism. She came to New York herself as a college student in the early 1940s, and she finished her bachelor's degree at Hunter College and decided that the most important direction for empowering the Puerto Rican community at that time in the early 50s was to strengthen the opportunities for young people to finish their education, whether that was completing high school or going on to college or beyond, and to collaborate and organize to create more opportunities for themselves, for their communities, and to help to build a perception of Puerto Rican youth that countered the stereotypes of gang members, of unemployed youth hanging out on corners, of kids who dropped out of high school or couldn't speak English, were not, you know, employable in a conventional middle-class sense. So her goal was to strengthen opportunities and also change the way young Puerto Ricans were perceived. And she was a founding member of a couple of important organizations. One was the Puerto Rican Association for Community Affairs, which was led by very young Puerto Rican professionals in the early 50s. And then she founded she's best known for founding the organization Aspira, which means in English to aspire, in 1961. And that was an organization intended to operate in collaboration with schools so that young people could create their own clubs, create their own leadership opportunities, and they would be supported by this, what became a national organization. The Aspira clubs spread out of New York City pretty quickly into other cities where there were sizable Puerto Rican communities. And although Aspira was frequently seen as a kind of mainstream organization that emphasized assimilation and middle-class values, et cetera, the fact was that a lot of the leaders of radical organizations or political activists of various stripes in the 1960s got their start as community organizers, as activists in the Aspira clubs in their various high schools.
Well, certainly radical actions and radical political actions were part of the repertoire of the Puerto Rican community and the Puerto Rican youth community in New York City. 1964 saw a school boycott, a citywide school boycott. What role did Puerto Ricans play in that boycott? And I guess Bayard Rustin called it the largest civil rights protest in the nation's history. So this is really worth spending some time on, huh?
Yes, it was a really important moment, not just in the visibility of Puerto Ricans as political actors in New York, but also in terms of a very effective collaboration with African Americans in New York on an issue that was of great consequence to both communities: the adequate resourcing of schools for African American and Puerto Rican kids. The boycott was a collaboration between African American leaders And a Puerto Rican labor leader and political leftist named Gerena Valentin, who had been had recently helped found a group called the National Association of Puerto Rican Civil Rights, which in fact was a response to ongoing incidents of police abuse and police brutality against the Puerto Rican community. Gerena Valentin worked with a couple of leaders from African American communities in New York to plan this massive boycott. And the idea was that they would force the New York City Board of Education to take seriously the problems of inequality, resource inequality, and also segregation. Although I should add that integration was not the primary goal necessarily. The primary goal was equality of resources and a greater degree of control by these communities over their schools.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Lauren Thomas is her name, L-O-R-R-I-N Thomas. She's Associate Professor of History and the Chair of the History Department at Rutgers University Camden. Her books include Puerto Rican Citizen, History and Political Identity in 20th Century New York City, and Rethinking the Struggle for Puerto Rican Rights. And that latter book was co-authored with Aldo Loria Santiago. You're right that the 1964 school boycott in New York City commanded national press coverage and was by all measures a success. 45% of students and 8% of teachers stayed out of school, and 2,600 picketers marched in front of 300 of the city's 860 schools in spite of 20-degree temperatures. Let's move the focus in the venue to higher education and the City College of New York specifically, and the year 1969. What did Puerto Rican and other students at CCNY do in 1969 that shook that institution to its core?
In 1969, Puerto Rican college students and actually a number of high school students who worked with them in their student organizations collaborated with African American students at City College and at some other campuses in the city university system, and made demands that the city university commit funds to create ethnic studies departments, Puerto Rican studies, African American studies, and they wanted greater attention to admissions, the proportion of students admitted to the more prestigious city university schools, especially City College, the flagship campus. There was a tiny proportion of Puerto Ricans and African Americans, relatively tiny, who were admitted to City College. So what these students did was they organized a takeover demanding equal access of students of color to these institutions. And it was part of a national movement. In fact, it was San Francisco State University that roughly simultaneously was engaged, where students, mostly Chicano and African American students there, were engaged in the same kind of struggle, the same kind of battle with the administration to create academic departments that reflected their cultural backgrounds, that incorporated academic study of the histories that these students brought with them into these institutions. And also they demanded in both San Francisco State and at CUNY greater admission or changes in admissions policies to allow more Black and Brown students admission to higher education.
And to what extent were the student protesters at CUNY, were their demands actually met?
The CUNY administration took this pretty seriously. The students shut down the campuses for a couple of weeks in the spring of 1969. It happened to be as the mayoral Democratic primary was heating up. And so, in fact, the CUNY strikes, as they were called, became a major topic of debate among the mayoral candidates. And the university, on the question of admissions, the administration responded fairly well, in part because they were already engaged. The board of CUNY and its high-level administrators were already engaged in some analysis about how to create more equitable access. So they were not, they sped up their process of tweaking the admissions policies in order to enable greater numbers of Black and Brown students from New York City public schools to go to college. What they also responded to fairly well was the authorizing of Puerto Rican studies and Black studies programs or departments, I mean, depended on the school, at most of the senior college and community college campuses between roughly 1969 and 1973. So the academic demands of the CUNY strikers were very effective within just a few years. They really did change the way Black studies, ethnic studies were incorporated into higher education. And this was became part of a trend that happened in many other schools in many other parts of the country thereafter. But the CUNY strikes, along with the San Francisco State student strikers, were at the forefront of this change.
So then how, Lauren, would you kind of sum up this 40-year period, right, 1930 to 1970, which is the focus of your article, again, your chapter in the volume, A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered. How would you sum up the progress that Puerto Ricans, and specifically Puerto Rican youth, had made in those decades? And I especially am thinking of the 60s, given all the ferment and the protests and the radical actions increasingly being taken by young Puerto Ricans, in the sense of kind of their ability to establish themselves as deserving citizens of the U.S. and their ability to flourish in a way, to get the opportunities they felt they deserved and to get their needs met?
I would answer that question in two parts. There was, first of all, a lot of progress throughout the 1960s in terms of drawing attention to the problems of access that Puerto Rican children and students at all levels had. These were issues that, as we've talked about for the last number of minutes, these were issues that had that parents, Puerto Rican parents, had pushed for since the 1920s. Bilingual, bicultural education, greater equity in their schools, more attention to the needs of migrant children and also second-generation children. But it was really through the activism of students, both at the high school level and the college level, and the young professional organizations that we talked about that supported these students. It was through all of these mechanisms that increased access to education, especially higher education, advanced considerably in the 1960s. The other part of the answer to that question is that during the 60s, increasingly toward the late 60s, young Puerto Ricans were part of the radical mobilizations of young people that were happening all over the country, in fact, all over the world. And they were also increasing visibility and opportunity for young Puerto Ricans, especially. They were doing it in different ways. One of the examples I talked about in the chapter is an organization of probably 20-somethings, Puerto Rican 20-somethings, started on the Lower East Side called the Real Great Society. This was a play on the name for President Johnson's anti-poverty programs, which he labeled as a group, he labeled those programs the Great Society. So the members of the Real Great Society were radical community organizers. They set up storefront offices. They created a program. Their most visible program was called the University of the Streets, where they found people to teach all kinds of classes, ranging from photography and karate to Puerto Rican history and the history of racism in the United States. And they opened it up to anybody who wanted to attend. Most of these were evening classes. They were not for credit, but they were part of a kind of expansion of opportunity and creating opportunities for connection. And it wasn't just, the wild youth who were taking part in these programs. The members of groups like the Real Great Society and also of the Young Lords organization, which was perhaps the most visible of these radical groups and remains perhaps the best remembered of the many, many organizations that flourished in Puerto Rican neighborhoods in New York and elsewhere in the 1960s and early 70s. What they were able to achieve was a kind of, they created community and they created opportunity by taking resources that the city would not provide. So for instance, the Young Lords, when they wanted to start a program for children, a free breakfast program for children and other kind of community education programs, they took over a church and they did it by arrangement with the pastor it was a complicated situation, but they thought, well, we'll use this unused space, the space that's not used many days of the week, and we'll open this up to the community. Many organizations were connected with or supported the increasingly visible practice of squatting, community organizations that focused on fair housing and justice in housing, took over buildings that were abandoned. This, especially in the 1970s, New York was mired in a fiscal crisis. There was also a pretty well-advanced trend of white flight. And there were a number of abandoned buildings in a lot of parts of New York City. And young Puerto Rican activists were among the people who took advantage of these available resources. It was technically illegal, but it was one of the ways that they helped create not just community, but opportunities and forms of safety for people who were poor and lacked other safe housing opportunities.
Lauren Thomas, she teaches history at Rutgers University Camden. Her books include Puerto Rican Citizen, History and Political Identity in 20th Century New York City, and she's contributed a chapter about Puerto Ricans in New York City to the volume A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. We turn now to one of the co-editors of A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered. Madalena Madinari is assistant professor in history, gender, women, and sexuality studies, and peace studies at Gustavus Adolphus College in Minnesota. When Madalena joined me recently, I asked what the volume A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered, U.S. Society in an Age of Restriction, 1924 to 1965, is fundamentally about.
So a lot of people think about this period between 1924 and 1965 as a time where not a lot of immigration happened because there was this really restrictive law in place passed in 24 and repealed in 65. And so essentially argued that immigration did not come to a halt. Immigration, in fact, continued for a lot of different reasons, in part because even though in theory Americans were restrictionist, in practice, they still needed migrants for economic reasons, for example, especially during World War II and in the 1950s and 60s. It's also the case that the United States admitted more people during World War II and in the 1950s for geopolitical reasons. And so not only more people arrived than a lot of people believe, but it's also the laws actually changed and started favoring people reuniting with their families, for example, admitting refugees, which was all categories that were outside this really rigid immigration system that was created in the 1920s. And it also, we argue that even though perhaps immigration did decline a little bit, this still was part of American identity. In other words, just because fewer people were coming, it didn't mean that Americans weren't still thinking about the role that immigration had in their lives, in their society, and in relation to American identity.
And remind us of the two federal laws that bookended this period, the law in 1924 and the law in 1965?
The Immigration Act of 1924 essentially banned almost all immigration from Asia, but it also passed a national origins quota system that was imposed on immigrants from the Eastern Hemisphere. So essentially said that only a specific number of immigrants could come from Europe, and the numbers were calculated in a way so that Southern Europe and Eastern Europe received very small yearly numbers, even though those were the countries where most immigrants wanted to come from. The law exempted the Western Hemisphere, so immigrants from the Western Hemisphere could keep coming in, but that same year in 1924, they also created a border patrol, and so they still were thinking about controlling immigration along the northern and southern border. In 1965, essentially, Congress repealed the national origins quota system, but it introduced a global system of yearly quotas, which was meant to be less discriminatory, but it ended up creating all sorts of other problems. But that's outside of the scope of our ontology.
Was the 1965 Hart-Celler Immigration Act, was that a dramatic departure from what immediately preceded it?
Not really. So usually the 1965 Act is seen as this law that completely changed the face of American society. But the truth is that a lot of what happened after 1965 was actually built upon changes that had happened during World War II and in the 1950s, when, because of the Cold War and geopolitical reasons, the United States had to admit, for example, refugees, displaced persons that were coming from parts of the world that had originally been deemed as undesirable. So a lot of Jewish refugees, but also immigrants from Asia, for example. And so technically, those people should not have come in, but because the role of the United States in the world changed, the U.S. Started changing those laws in the 50s. The biggest change, perhaps, is the fact that the quotas end up being imposed on the Western Hemisphere under 1965, and that will create a lot of problems that hadn't been anticipated, like undocumented immigration.
What overall point is this book trying to make about the connections between immigration and foreign policy, U.S. foreign policy?
Essentially, during World War II, when the United States presented itself as the arsenal of democracy, essentially a lot of the countries involved in the war said, well, if you are presenting yourself as a democratic nation, why do you, for example, have a law on the books that completely excludes certain groups of immigrants, especially those from Asia? And so in 1943, the United States ended up repealing the exclusion on Chinese because China was an ally during World War II. But that didn't mean that all of a sudden all Chinese could come in. The annual quota for China was still of 105 people per year, so not exactly huge. The other, from a foreign policy perspective, especially during the Cold War in the early 1950s, there are a lot of these countries that are putting pressure on the United States essentially to start leading in refugee admissions. And so in the 50s, the U.S. makes a lot of policy exceptions in order to admit refugees, first refugees from World War II, but also later on refugees fleeing communist countries because it's tied to Cold War priorities. And then there's actually an essay in the anthology that talks about how the restrictive regime that the United States passed actually had a ripple effect across the Americas, because in order for the United States to uphold this regime, it had to ask for the help of other countries. So there is an essay that talks about the impact of the 1924 Act on Cuba, because a lot of Europeans were trying to get to Cuba to then come to the United States. And so the United States was trying to put a lot of pressure on Cuba to collaborate, and Cuba was kind of resisting, or at least using those demands to extract something back.
So listeners to Against the Grain might have heard my interview with Elliot Young a while back about his article in this volume, A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered, U.S. Society in an Age of Restriction, 1924 to 1965. We are joined by a co-editor of the book, Maddalena Madinari. His piece was called Remote Control and the Continuing Legacy of Racism in Immigration Legislation. You've just heard Lauren Thomas talking about Puerto Rican youth and the forging of an American identity, 1930 to 1970. Maddalena, what are some of the other chapters in the volume, in addition to what you mentioned about the piece by Kathleen Lopez about U.S. immigration policy and the Cuban connection?
The anthology is divided into three sections. One, the first one is about the policy and the legal repercussion. And so that section, for example, has the debate about refugee admissions during the Cold War and how complicated those negotiations were, even though there were a lot of organizations in the United States that were trying to actually bring refugees in, so they would vouch for these refugees. In the second section, which is focused primarily on labor and immigration, there is, for example, an essay about the Bracero program, which is a program that brought temporary Mexican workers from the middle of World War II to 1964. So a clear recognition that immigration was indeed still needed. But there is also a little known development that a lot of people think that the Bracero program was the only program during this time period that brought temporary migrants. But there's an essay by Ichiro Azuma that actually looks at how the Japanese-American community organized a temporary worker program with Japanese immigrants. And it had really interesting repercussions, because these people who were brought to the United States, on one hand, were supposed to help the American economy, but on the other hand, they were also supposed to absorb American democracy and American ideals and then bring them back to Japan once they returned. And the last section really focuses on immigration and the connection to belonging and American identity. That one has an essay by Ruth Ellen Wassum about the disconnect between the desire of Americans to see some sort of reform in 1965 and the negotiations at the congressional level with the president that ended up shaping the kind of dysfunctional law that ended up being passed in 1965. There is also a really powerful essay about the emotions and the feelings that go into the Bracero program. So what it means to live separately when you have to leave your family behind. And he uses poetry and music to kind of explore the emotional side of migration, of this powerful experience.
A lot of people might look at a book like this in a superficial way and say, well, this is just history. This is just old news. So why is it important to understand these developments that might have happened in decades past in order to make sense of what's happening today or what might come down the pike?
I think the biggest lesson is that if we really believe that very restrictive immigration laws work, this book shows that that is not the case. In other words, and it's not just because immigrants will keep coming, but it's also because the need in the United States for immigrants doesn't disappear if you're purely talking about economic migrants. I think we also, the other way that is relevant is because what happens in the United States has foreign policy repercussion, not just in the Americas, but around the world. Other countries do look at what the United States does when it comes to immigration. And this racist immigration law that was passed in 1924 actually caused significant problems during World War II and shortly afterwards. And so viewing immigration as an exclusive domestic policy actually does more harm than good. And I think from an identity perspective, you also realize that having immigration laws that mark certain immigrants as undesirable have really troubling consequences for people who belong to these communities and can cause trauma that is not easy to overcome, either in the short term or in the long term. And you also see that the rhetoric tends to be divisive, and it kind of then affects other area of American society too. It becomes an issue beyond just immigration.
And in your mind, how important is it for politicians and lawmakers and administrators and government to pay attention to this scholarly work being done in immigration, to educate themselves on many of the insights coming out of the academic community about what immigration has meant in the past and its, as you said, kind of widespread effects, whereas we might just think of it as a domestic issue?
I think, you know, I could be cliche and say we can always learn from the past, but I think the most important thing is that the situation we're in today has a long history. And I think the better we understand the history, the more likely we are to find a solution. But I also feel like studying history, ironically, would also help us humanize immigrants and the immigration debates we're having. Sometimes I have the feeling that we talk about immigrants in very abstract terms as if they were not people. And that's why we decided to include a section on identity in our anthology, because it was really important for us to understand that immigration affects everyone in U.S. society, even if you yourself are not an immigrant. So there are definitely foreign policy implications, economic implications, but also it has a huge connection to how we see ourselves as a country, as a nation, and for us, what it means to be an American.
Maddalena Marinari, she teaches history, gender, women, and sexuality studies, and peace studies at Gustavus Adolphus College, and she's co-editor with Maria Cristina Garcia and Madeline Hsu of the volume A Nation of Immigrants Reconsidered, U.S. Society in an Age of Restriction, 1924 to 1965. It's published by University of Illinois Press. Maddalena, congratulations to you and your co-editors for this volume, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.